So I'll be talking today about a 10-year project that I've been working on to explore the history of the U.S. National Anthem. And it really came out of my teaching. I teach history of American music course for the University of Michigan. And I wanted to get students thinking about issues of sort of American identity. What does song tell us about our lives? How does it reflect social context, get involved in politics, all these issues that go beyond music as entertainment and really speak about music as a kind of social force. And so the Star Spangled Banner seemed like a great place to start because it's something that all my students had a relationship with, all of us in this room have a relationship with. I mean, even if you're not a citizen, you're hearing this song all the time and wondering what's going on with all these people singing the Star Spangled Banner all the time. And so I wanted to have the original version as Francis Scott Key might have known it. And that led me down the rabbit hole, if you will, to really exploring the issues and story of the Star Spangled Banner, which turns out to be way more detailed than I had imagined. I really expected it to be a pretty quick research project. And as I say, it's been going on and will continue to go on for about a decade. So my overall sense now is that the Star Spangled Banner has mutated and changed and grown and sort of developed alongside the country. So really what we have is a kind of symbiotic relationship between song and nation that actually tells us about the history of the country as it tells us about the history of the song. And so that's really the overall topic of today. So we're going to look at the history of the United States through the lens of our national anthem. So I thought I'd start off with a little quiz on the background of the Star Spangled Banner. This, if for those of you who maybe took a look at the exhibit as we were getting ready today, you might have picked up some of the answers in this. Others will have to reach back to your high school American history class and maybe come up with these answers. But let's take a look. So this is an easy one we're going to start out with here. We're going to build your confidence. The question is, who created the lyric to the U.S. National Anthem and when? Francis Scott Key, good, excellent. And when did he do it?
When the British were shelling certain fort.
When the British were selling a certain fort, exactly. Anybody know the name of that fort?
Fort McHenry.
Fort McHenry in Baltimore, right. And what year was it? I sort of gave that away when I said it was 200 years ago. 1812. Was 1812 200 years ago? The War of 1812, exactly. The War of 1812, but the battle itself is in 1814. So we did pretty well at the very beginning of the War of 1812 because the British were tied down with this guy named Napoleon. And then right around end of 1813, 1814, they sent the real British troops to the United States, and then the tide turned a little bit. It included the burning of Washington, D.C., and then the subsequent attack on Fort McHenry. And so you guys have got this answer well in hand, Francis Scott Key. And the date, which I sort of see as the birthday, if you will, the flash of inspiration that leads to the Star Spangled Banner is September 14th, 1814, which is the morning of the dawn's early light when Francis Scott Key sees the flag and the battle is over. The British basically give up. They had such an easy time attacking Washington, D.C. that they get frustrated that Baltimore is putting up such a stiff resistance. They bomb the harbor for over 24 hours. And the fort holds, and they basically decide to find an easier location to attack. So that's our moment. The song is probably written over the next couple days, because unlike modern warfare where you're talking about jet planes flying in and radar and very mobile troops, in this case things aren't that mobile. Part of the reason the British were so were able to do such a long bombardment is that their guns shot farther than our guns. Right, so they parked about 2 miles from the fort. The fort's gun didn't quite reach to the ships, and they could fire away hour after hour. So they weren't in a big hurry to leave. And Francis Scott Key, who was sort of under guard during the battle, was compelled to stay in the Chesapeake Bay, sort of among the British vessels, and where he had gone to negotiate a release of a prisoner. And he had successfully done that, but basically, when you stick a national poet on a boat with nothing to do for 2 or 3 days, you end up with a lyric to his new song. So that's what indeed happened. And the song, a lot of what we know as Americans about the Star Spangled Banner is really encapsulated in the lyric itself. So it has sort of its own history, right? Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's light gleaming. So it tells the story of the bombardment. Was the flag still there? He saw the flag. But that's really, in a sense, that the only knowledge we have of the song. And I'll tell you some of the reasons why our knowledge is so limited. Part of it is the problem of this picture, but the other part is Francis Scott Key himself. So question number two, there's the bombardment of Fort McHenry, but question number two, it has to do with the music that accompanies the song. So you can see here, I'll get my pointer right there, you can see that in the center, this is actually the first broadside print of the Star-Spangled Banner. You can so see that originally the title was not the Star-Spangled Banner at all, but the Defense of Fort McHenry. So Key was describing a very specific event in a very specific place and time, but he writes four verses, 1, 2, 3, 4. So we usually only sing this first one at baseball games, but there are four. And then he indicates right here that there's a tune, there's a melody that you use to realize this text. So the text really is a lyric, and it's not so much a poem set to music, but rather a lyric created and invented in Key's imagination to fit this melody. And I'll show you a little bit later that he had known this melody for a while. So, but the question is, where did the music come from? So who wrote the music? And when did they write it? It's a little harder question. It's a great American name, yeah.
Didn't the British write it? It's a British song?
It is an English song, yeah. Exactly. It's from London, yeah.
Specifically a drinking song?
It's reputed to be a drinking song, and I take a little bit of umbrage at that. But it deserves its reputation to a certain extent, but it didn't start out originally as a drinking song. Anybody know where it's from? So the composer's name is John Smith, or John Stafford Smith. He's an English composer living in London. He's actually one of the royal composers for the Royal Chapel in London. So he writes a lot of religious music, but he's also an award-winning writer or composer of popular songs. And there's a lot of these singing clubs, basically kind of men's a cappella choruses and social clubs that are in London. The most famous is called the Ketch Club, and one of their competitors is called the Anacreontic Society. So this is the Anacreontic Song, and you can see that the lyric for the Anacreontic Song is by Ralph Tomlinson, who either was about to become president or was actually president of the club at the time that he wrote this. It says that he's the late president of that society, because by the time they get around to publishing this music, it's a couple years later, and he actually has already passed away. But the song is written right around the time of our own revolution, 1775, 76, but it doesn't get published until a couple years later. So it's not really known in the colonies, and well, until the federal America, until probably the 1790s. But initially, it's a song that's becomes very popular in London. But it's a musician's club anthem. So it's a singing society that's interested in literature, it's interested in song, and they have this as sort of their theme song or their constitutional song. So the president of the club or his deputy sings it at every single meeting. Meetings of the Anacreontic Society start with a two-hour symphony concert, chamber music, go on to a dinner, and then proceed to an evening of song. So you basically come with your wives to the concert, you send your wives home, you break out a little bit of alcohol, and have a good evening of song. And what would start the transition from the dinner to the singing around 10 o'clock in the evening was the president invoking the song. They would sing actually a benediction, and then there would be a series of sort of, if you've ever gone to like the U of M Glee Club or the Friars, it'd be more that kind of event. So there was a lot of fun, but there's also a lot of seriousness. And the Anacreontic Song is named after the name of the society, which is the Anacreontic Society. It's named after the poet Anacreon from Greek history. And he's certainly known for writing sort of both heroic verse, but also sort of frivolous verse. So there's a lot of fun and sociality involved with this club, but it is something that's aspiring to kind of Greek ideals of literature and a sort of a learned society. So that's where this is coming from. What I have here is a recording we made sort of as part of my initial interest in the song at the university to play for my students. And I got my friend Jerry Blackstone, who's our director of choral activities, and a group of our students together to sing both the first version of the Star-Spangled Banner and this, the Anacreontic Song. So we'll listen to what it might have sounded like if we were present at a meeting of the Anacreontic Society.
sent a petition that he their inspirer and patron would be. When his answer arrived from the jolly old Grecian, voice, fiddle, and flute no longer be mute. I'll lend you my name and inspire you to boot. And besides, I'll instruct you like me to entwine the myrtle of Venus with Bacchus as mine.
And besides, I'll instruct you like me to entwine the myrtle of Venus with Bacchus as mine.
You can hear the way the music works. It's an all men's chorus. It breaks into four-part harmony. It's accompanied by a harpsichord. So my thought is it's not really a pub song in the way we might think of a traditional drinking song. There are a couple reasons why we might consider it to be a drinking song. I just want to emphasize with this slide that Key wrote a song and not a poem. So most people who I talk to will say, oh yeah, Key wrote a poem and someone else later set it to music. In this case, we know because it appears in the very first print, which Key himself had printed, about 1,000 copies, and he distributed it to the soldiers who were defending the fort. So Key, who's living in the District of Columbia at this time, is, and I think of him as, in some ways as one of the first Americans, because he's a person who's really affiliated with the nation. He's affiliated with the national government rather than their state government. So we talk a lot about states' rights and those issues today. Certainly goes back to the Continental Congress in 1787 and all of these issues of early federal America. And Key, who was a lawyer in the district, really, I think, more affiliated or connected with the national government, really, even than the state government, although he was born in Maryland. But he gives this poem or this song with the tune indicated to the defenders of the fort, right? And he entitles it Defense of Fort McHenry, and it really celebrates their heroism. Another little thing I like to point out is that the first word is the letter O. Almost every modern version of it, I see it has O-H there, but it's actually O exclamation mark in Key's text. And then here is this question of the drinking song nature. So there's a couple reasons why you might think it's a drinking song. It's the anacreontic song, and as I said, he writes a lot of sort of drinking song, wine, women, and song kind of poetry. It says right here that the words are by Ralph Tomlinson, but it says, as sung at the Crown and Anchor Tavern in the Strand. So that, I think, is the primary reason people think of it as a drinking song, because it says it's sung at a tavern. The tavern, the closest thing we have in Ann Arbor to the tavern is sort of Weber's Inn. I mean, it's a place that has a huge ballroom where you can have a symphony orchestra playing a concert, right? So it's not sort of the pub underneath the bridge or, you know, singing pints of ale kind of thing. It's much more of a high society, aristocratic club. You have to pay an annual subscription to be a member of the club. You can bring one guest to the concert. So it's more of a kind of, if you see a kind of entrepreneurial networking, you know, high society club than it is a typical pub song. And as I said, most pubs didn't have harpsichords hanging out in them. They're hard to keep in tune if you're dumping beer all over them. So not so much a drinking song. So really the constitutional song, the theme song, if you will, of this musician society. However, what happens with this melody is that the melody escapes the club, right? It becomes this popular tune, in part because the deputy of the president who often sang the song was a very popular actor on the London stage. And so he would sing this song for encores. They would sort of parody these aristocratic clubs in the local theaters by singing the song and sort of humorous skits. And the tune becomes known outside of the functioning of the club, and then they start making up new words. And one of the things they make up is a set of drinking song lyrics. This is actually, I'll play my favorite drinking song parody of this tune. It's one of a five or six that I know, but this one was actually written by students at Harvard in the late 18th century, and the pen name of the Harvard student was Charlie Chatterbox, who put this together. But this is the song as sung by the students at Michigan, but in the guise of our students' friends at Harvard.
Ye lovers of liquor, friendship, and joy, let Greek and let Latin no longer annoy. Triadic of Homer and Virgil.
So it's called The Bumper of Wine. Okay, number three, when did the banner become the official U.S. national anthem? It's not 1776, that's my hint. 1931, very good. You win the prize. You read it over here. Well, this is a fine exhibit. I don't know who put this together, but it's really excellent. You should definitely spend some time with it. Yes, 1931, so less than 100 years ago. So it's really relatively recent, even though now it seems like it's sort of always been here, that it has this long history, that it really there's this kind of symbolic match between song and nation. This is something that actually grew very organically and grew as people sang the song and sort of burrowed it into American cultural memory, which really happens over the course of 117 years, right, from 1814 until 1931. And that's when it becomes the U.S. national anthem. And the person who deserves a lot of credit is Reuben Ross Holloway, who was the president of the Daughters of the War of 1812, was a socialite in Baltimore, and she got the Baltimore Senator Charles Linthicum to advocate in Congress with a whole series of bills. I think there were 30-some bills proposing that the Star-Spangled Banner be named the U.S. national anthem, and it had several problems. It was hard to sing. It was a sort of song born of war. It was a song with an English tune attached to it rather than an American tune. It was associated with drinking songs, so in the Prohibition era, sort of a dicey proposition to have that become the national anthem. So there were lots of things against it. The thing that was really in its favor and that made it sort of the undeniable national anthem was that's how people used it. So whenever there was a threat to the country, like World War I, which really sort of deeply burned this song into sort of American identity. And really, it was the only choice. Even today, I hear people say, oh, wouldn't it be great if America the Beautiful were the national anthem? It's just such a gorgeous song. And it is a gorgeous song. But I think one of the functions of a national anthem is a kind of militaristic function, is a function that when the country's under threat, it's something that brings people together. It sort of galvanizes people to respond to a national disaster, to sort of come together as a community. And the America the Beautiful would work great for probably 95% or 90, hopefully 99% of a nation's history. But at the time that sort of you really need a national anthem to bring people together, you want something that has the energy and the athleticism and the kind of passion that the Star-Spangled Banner has. So I don't think it was an accident that Francis Scott Key chose this particular tune, and we'll discuss why in a little bit. Okay. True, false, number four. Songs like The Banner were rare and unusual in American history. You've got a 50-50 chance. Yes. So true, false, yes. Okay, very good. And the answer sort of is yes. So my answer to this anyway is false. The songs were in fact quite common, but songs as successful as the Star-Spangled Banner that we still remember and sing today, 200 years later, are very rare. So it's a little bit of both. But this type of practice that Francis Scott Key actually does many, many times, he writes 10 religious hymns, he writes 4 or 5 songs, always taking a well-known melody and writing a new set of words to it. So that cultural practice has a long tradition. It's called broadside balladry. It starts in the 16th century in England, and of course the colonists bring it over with them, but would have involved sort of early printing practices where we had movable type and we could very cheaply create a set of words on paper. Putting music notation with note heads and rhythms was very expensive. It had to be hand-drawn on a metal plate and then after engraved, inked, and printed sort of one at a time. With movable type, you could, of course, put out newspapers and words, and there was a lot of very skilled typographers who could set that. So just a set of words on paper with an indication of a well-known melody. Say today we had like Take Me Out to the Ball Game or Happy Birthday or America the Beautiful or any of those kinds of tunes. We all could sing a set of lyrics to those melodies because we know those melodies. If we were in colonial days, we'd know a lot more music. We'd probably know more like 100 tunes by memory, be able to sing them. Why? There's no recording. Right? Today, if we want to listen to music, we just take out our phone and turn on the MP3s or listen to Spotify or whatever. We have a vast library of musical experience that's not about us making the music ourselves. right? In 1814, in Francis Scott Key's day, if you're going to hear music, you have to perform it, or you have to be around live, you know, other musicians. So music is happening in church, music is happening in the sort of the, you know, town square, it's happening in the tavern. So there's a lot more people making music. It's much more part of our daily experience. So we just end up with a larger repertory. And a lot of these tunes, like Heart of Oak, Rosin the Bow, Anacreon in Heaven, were vehicles for locals, our friends and neighbors, to celebrate a birthday, to celebrate an important event, to celebrate, you know, victory in an important battle, and then to share that. And they would be printed on an individual piece of paper and sold for like a penny. So that was what a broadside was, or a single sheet, broadsheet, was this single sheet of paper with words on it that you could buy with the lyrics. American broadsides were really quite common. There's three of them here, but there literally are thousands and thousands of these things. They were reprinted in newspapers. Almost every issue of a newspaper would have a poet's corner. And in that poet's corner would be a set of, you know, a couple, it could be poetry, it could be a set of song lyrics. These are three broadsides. This one's called The Star-Spangled Banner. I'll talk about this one in a little bit. It was actually written by a poet in Michigan. This is called Columbia and Independence and is a new patriotic song. And then this is Wells and McComas, and it's actually says a funeral and monument song, and this is from the era of the Civil War. So really these go sort of from the time of Francis Scott Key and the Star-Spangled Banner up through the Civil War. And all of these lyrics are actually sung to the same tune that we know as the Star-Spangled Banner. So there are literally hundreds of different texts in the 19th century that are sung to the tune we now know as the Star-Spangled Banner. So what Francis Scott Key was doing was really entering a party of all people, creating new lyrics, creating a kind of conversation, a dialogue in music around issues and events of the day, using a lot of different tunes, but often using the tune we know as the Star-Spangled Banner, if they want to comment on things having to do with politics or military heroism or American identity. And some of that is deepened by Francis Scott Key. So as his song becomes more popular, as it sort of rides the wave of patriotism that follows the victory at Baltimore and then Andrew Jackson's victory in New Orleans a few months later, which ends the war of 1812 and 1815, there's a new sense of confidence. I mean, we beat the British the first revolution, we've had sort of our second war of independence, we beat the British again, maybe we sort of got something going here with this country, and maybe we should be proud of it. And so that's one reason why Francis Scott Key's song continues to get reprinted. It gets taken out of one newspaper and copied in another newspaper. It gets taken out of the newspaper and put in a book called A Songster, which has a whole collection of these texts. So that's sort of where these are coming from. This, as I said, is Francis Scott Key's original. You see the title, Defense of Fort McHenry, again, the tune. But there's some interesting stuff about this paragraph at the top here. So this is one of the bits of original sourcing we have on the history of the song. It's the text that Key himself, or maybe one of his appointees who was taking it to the printer, sort of had put as a header to explain where the song is from. And there's two things I want to point out to you. One has to do with the sort of function, I think, of broadside balladry. So here he says, describing the author, which goes unnamed, he says, he watched the flag at the fort through the whole day with an anxiety that can be better felt than described. So one of the things that's sort of said about broadside ballads is that in an era sort of before literacy, before public schools, a lot of people couldn't read the newspaper. And so if you wanted to find out the news, you could hear it in a song, right? So the gentleman singing in the town square, selling the broadsides, you know, could tell you what's going on. That's an interesting theory and sort of makes sense at the surface, but it's probably not the most efficient way to get your news. I mean, if you're really wondering, hey, did we win or lose? Just hold on a second. Oh, say, can you see? You know, it's probably not the best way to just get the answer to your question. If you want to know what's happened, if you want to know the facts, you would just ask someone a question, right? You probably wouldn't have them sing a song. But what it says here can be better felt than described. So the notion of feelings rather than facts, I think, is really what these songs are after. So what Francis Scott Key is telling us is not who won. What he's telling is what it feels that we won. right? What the significance of this is for the nation, for him as a citizen, for what his sort of his hopes and dreams for the country. The fact that we see this song now as sort of being an image of the United States has more to do with how the country grew than it was with what it was in 1814. In 1814, what Francis Scott Key is communicating is a kind of, well, first of all, his anxiety, his despair, his relief, but also his dream, his hope for the nation, what it might become. If people actually said, maybe we should get together, maybe we should strengthen the federal government, maybe we really should be a coherent nation rather than a group of individual states, and that would give us really a sense of being a patriotic country. And this text sort of leads in that direction. That does happen, but it doesn't really describe the state of affairs in 1814. So that feeling rather than facts, I think, is why we have these songs, right? By marrying the lyrics, the words with melody, we find out what it feels like. And that's why he chose this melody, which, as I said, is very athletic. It's very sort of proud. It's very aggressive. It takes a lot of courage to even sing it, right, to hit those high notes, right? It's an unusual national anthem because of its range. The other thing that's interesting is he says the annex song was composed under the following circumstances. A gentleman had left Baltimore. So he doesn't say, I, Francis Scott Key. He just says, a gentleman. Right, so this is sort of the beginning of the confusion. There actually are copies of the Star Spangled Banner that credit the text to Mr. McHenry, you know, as the name of the fort rather than the name of Francis Scott Key, or even, you know, that say Mr. Barton Key or Mr. Keys. There's all sorts of errors in the history of the Star Spangled Banner, in part because Francis Scott Key himself didn't want the focus to be on him. So he's a gentleman, he's a lawyer, he's a, you know, sort of aspiring national figure. It's a little bit low class to be running around writing lyrics and publishing them for, you know, your own aggrandizement and popularity. Politics were a little different then than they are today, apparently. But anyway, so he actually keeps it anonymous. I mean, he says it's a gentleman who writes this. So, and the Anacreontic song is a fairly high-class song. As I said, it comes from this club. It's a fairly sophisticated song musically in terms of its melody, how hard it is to sing. It takes a trained voice to really do it justice. So it's sort of attached to this highfalutin or elevated text, but it's kept anonymous. He really wants the focus to be on the defense of Fort McHenry, on the soldiers who defended it, not on him as the author. So that's really what that's about. And of course, because Francis Scott Key never writes the story, of how he wrote it, that allows other people to come in and take credit for it, including saying things like, oh yeah, I was the one who wrote the melody, or I'm the one who noticed that these words happened to fit this Anacreontic song, so I deserve the credit for that. And one of his relatives claimed that credit, several musicians of the day claimed that credit, and since Francis Scott Key himself never gave us his first-person description of what he did, we have to infer it from other things rather than from the facts. But there's several reasons why no one could have accidentally matched up this tune and this text. One is, as we see, that it's not accidental at all. He, from the very beginning, says the tune is Anacreon in heaven. But the other thing is that the Anacreontic song and its parody lyrics have a unique poetic form. So they have 8 lines, and they have 9 rhymes in those 8 lines. So a lot of poetry has end rhymes and pairs of couplets, but in all Anacreontic parodies that are at least the more sophisticated ones, there are a few Anacreontic parodies that where the poet didn't notice that there was an extra rhyme in it. But line 5, the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there, right? So glare, air, and there is a triple rhyme in 3 lines. So that's where the extra rhyme comes in. It's an internal rhyme in line 5. And so you don't accidentally write a poem with 8 lines and 9 rhymes in it. It really has to be done. And there are some other reasons why we know Francis Scott Key knew this melody. So what was Key feeling? If this is about the feelings rather than the facts, what was he feeling? Well, it says in the text that he was feeling anxiety. Well, why was he feeling anxiety? And this is, I think, One of the facts about the Star Spangled Banner that should be much wider and more widely known is that Francis Scott Key himself was a pacifist initially, but when the British attacked his hometown of Washington, D.C., being an educated man, he was called into the militia, and being educated, he was an officer in this case, in the artillery troops. And so he was one of the defenders of Washington, D.C. about 3 weeks before the Battle of Baltimore on August 24th, in probably one of the most ignominious battles in American history. It's often referred to as the Bladensburg Races because we just took off and ran. The defense of Washington, D.C. was very poor, both logistically and number of people. Washington, D.C. is also sort of a nothing town in 1814, right? It's created by an act of Congress in 1800 because they want a place that would be neutral, right, that would stay out of the politics or everything else. Washington, D.C. is still a very strange place politically, right? That you don't have an elected representative who votes in Congress, so taxation without representation still happens in Washington, D.C. It actually has larger population than many states out west, so it's an anomaly. But one of the things about it was that they built it in a swamp, right? They had to build it on land that Maryland and Virginia and nobody else wanted, right? So it's not really great land. It doesn't have a lot of people there. It doesn't have a lot of farming there. So it's a tough place to call out the militia because there aren't that many people living there. The people who are there are there for services of the government, like a lawyer named Francis Scott Key. So anyway, they are defending it. They don't do a very good job. The Battle of Bladensburg lasts about an hour. The British pretty much march in unopposed into Washington, and they take revenge on the U.S. for the burning of York, which is current-day Toronto, which we did at the beginning of War of 1812 when we invaded Canada. Nobody's really sure if we did it intentionally, but it happened. And so in revenge, they burned the federal buildings of Washington, D.C. and set it aflame. So when Francis Scott Key, 3 weeks later, is on a boat in the harbor, you know, outside of Baltimore on the Chesapeake Bay, hearing the boasts of the British officers saying, yeah, we're going to have dinner in Baltimore tonight, and they're thinking they're going to have as much trouble with Baltimore as they had with Washington, D.C., which is not much, Francis Scott Key has no reason to doubt them, right? I mean, he saw how quickly they took D.C. He pretty much expects the same thing to happen in Baltimore. Baltimore, of course, is a much bigger city. It's the third largest city in the United States at the time. It has a big, thriving port. It does a lot of, it's sort of the center of shipbuilding in the United States at the time. So it's a very different place than Washington, D.C., and they do successfully defend it. So it's that relief and hope that he sees, which is captured in this 1912 painting that's pretty famous by Percy Moran called Dawn's Early Light, when he sees the flag. So he has that anxiety, he has this relief, he has hope for what it could mean that the flag has survived. Maybe we won't go back to British rule. Right? Maybe this country will survive. Maybe my home will stay the capital of the United States of America. So that's what he's feeling, and that's what's communicated by the text of the Star Spangled Banner. So this painting, as I mentioned earlier, is another source of many of the misconceptions that I have been working against in my research. It's a beautiful sort of poetic interpretation from the centennial of the Star Spangled Banner. So it was painted by Percy Moran in 1912 to celebrate the 100th birthday upcoming of the not quite yet national anthem, but a very popular patriotic song, really ever since the Civil War. But it does many things that depict this moment of inspiration that aren't true. One of the things is that Francis Scott Key is way too close to the fort. I mean, in this picture, he's probably about 100 yards from the fort. The British line was 3 miles from the fort. Francis Scott Key was probably 3 miles back from that. So he's about 6 miles from the fort. If he can see the flag at all, it's through a spyglass. It's not just by looking out and seeing it in the dawn's early light. The other thing that Moran does is that he juxtaposes the Americans. So this is Skinner, who's his sort of first officer, and Key with the British soldiers who are dejected. Like, I can't believe we lost. I can't believe that the flag is still there. When in fact, Francis Scott Key was not on a British boat at all. He was on his own American truce ship, which had come up to the British fleet. He had gotten off that ship negotiated the release of the prisoners. They released him and the prisoners, but sent him back to his own boat to wait the end of the battle because they didn't want him getting on shore and giving up any information. You know, because they don't have radar at the time, they don't have radio communications, right? Information about just how many troops there are, how many ships they are, what they've got on the ships, how much ammunition they have, anything that they might have overheard would have been very valuable in the defense of Baltimore. And so they just had to wait out the battle. So they're under guard, but they're not really prisoners, and they're on an American ship. You certainly wouldn't give Francis Scott Key a large cannon if you were in the middle of the battle. So that's another thing that doesn't quite add up here. But the sense of crisis and the sense of relief, I think, and the sense of inspiration by the flag, and there's almost this kind of, you know, God-like glow around the flag in this painting, which is actually reproduced right here if you want to see a little better picture of it afterwards. But this painting has also perpetuated a lot of misinformation, which since we don't have any accurate information from Key, you know, the misinformation sort of takes over. All right, last question. Do we sing the anthem today as it was done originally? Probably not. You're right. I wouldn't have asked this question if the answer was yes. So the answer is no. We don't sing it quite the same way. And so this is a recording of our students singing at the university. We know they don't sing it quite the same way, but how is it different from what you expected or what you're used to?
It's actually very moving.
Yeah. No, I think it is a very powerful song, and that's its emotional strength is really what made it successful. All right, I'll give you a few hints. It's a little bit faster, I think, than what we sing today. The tempos we sing today change a little bit depending on the mood of the event or the occasion. It's going to be a little different at a football game that will be at a high school graduation, or a little different than, say, a military funeral. Might have slightly different tempos. But in this case, it's the tempo on the original imprint, which I think I have a picture of here. Yep, this is the original imprint that we sang from. So this is a fall of 1814, what's called the Carr edition. So it's actually, the music is arranged by Thomas Carr, who's an Anglican organist, and his dad runs a music printing business in Baltimore, and they're good friends of the Keys. So Francis Scott Key goes over to the shop and actually requests that they put this together. And, you know, of course, we all know what tune it goes with, so they set it to the anachronistic tune. And there's some really important things about this particular imprint. One is the title. So this is the very first time the title The Star-Spangled Banner appears with the song, because remember, before it was called Defense of Fort McHenry. This is a wise thing to do if you're a sheet music publisher and you're trying to sell music, right? You don't want to refer to something that only the people of Baltimore would care about. You want to reference the flag, maybe, that's repeated in the lyric, which is a common way that people learn and memorize musical titles to ask for it, but it also broadens the appeal really to everybody. Rather than making it a topical thing about a specific battle, we start to make it an abstract symbol that could transcend time and place and therefore find more customers, right? So that's one thing it does. Another thing it does is it adds a little sharp here So it changes the melody a little bit. So being an educated organist, Mr. Carr sort of fixes some of the voice leading that's made to sound a little bit more sort of primitive or ancient, intentionally by Mr. Smith. Yeah.
Didn't they sing in a little bit higher key,
too? Yeah, so that was actually sung in the key of C, which is the pitch is not standardized at this time, so different instruments in different towns and even different parts of the town would not necessarily be at the same pitch level. But generally speaking, it was higher. So something in the key of C, again, takes a skilled singer. That's why we got Justin, one of our best tenors, to sing it in this recording. But you'll see that the tempo is marked conspirata, with spirit, right? Whereas a more typical tempo marking today would be maestoso, would be sort of majestic, right? So now we sing it more like a sacred hymn, something that sort of has gravitas and weight to it. In 1814, this is a song of celebration. This is, we kicked the British out. Yeah! Right? So this is a party tune. So it's a quicker tempo. The other big difference has to do with this ending. Do you notice what happened with the ending? Was compressed? Yeah, it's it might seem like that, but it's actually sung twice. So this part here says second time chorus. So you go through and you sing it. Or the ramparts we watch, we're singing, rockets for glare, bombs bursting air. Oh, say does that star spangled banner yet wave, or the land of the free and the home of the brave. Repeat, you sing it again with chorus. So the first time it's sung by an individual soloist. Right, the last time through, the final two lines are repeated, first sung by a soloist, then sung by the community. This reflects the way the anacreontic song worked for the club back in London. Right, the president sings it. Okay, boys, let's dedicate. You know, long live the club, and they say, yeah, long live the club. Right, so the community repeats and affirms the words of the club president. Francis Scott Key uses the same thing. He says, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? Question mark. And then the community joins in. They're interested in the answer to this question, too. They ask the question again. So there's this social ritual built into the song that we ended up dropping out because it just slowed things down. All right, it takes too much time. So, but this repeat is characteristic of performances of the Star-Spangled Banner and all these other hundreds of lyrics that are used to it all the way up until World War I. So this is a relatively recent thing we've lost, in part because it's become the national anthem officially, and it gets done so much more often, and sort of in this kind of, okay, let's move through it, right? So that, I think they cut off that last part because of the repetition. And there's actually a military regulation from 1905 that says, come on, this it's taken too long, stop doing the repeat. So that's when, one of the reasons we know they were doing the repeat is that they had to pass a military regulation to stop people from doing the repeat. But it's the tempo and then that dynamic between the solo singer and the group response, between the sort of leader, if you will, and then the community, that I think is part of what makes this early version so special. The other thing I wanted to point out to you is that this is the single most valuable piece of sheet music in the history of printing. Right, so there are lots of more valuable pieces of music. So a handwritten copy of Mozart's G minor symphony would be more valuable than this piece of paper, right? Because it's in the hand of Mozart, the hand of Beethoven, whatever. So it's not the most valuable piece of music, but for a commercially mass-produced piece of sheet music, a single piece of paper that was put on a printing press and they cranked out hundreds of copies, there are only about a dozen of these that survive. So the last time one was sold was in 2010 and went for $500,000. I can't imagine what it would go for now. The previous one, this is the one we own here in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan. It's in the Clements Library. And then this is a different one, but the one that was sold at auction. So it's one of the 12 or so surviving copies. But if you happen to go home after today's lecture and you want to look through your great-grandfather's or great-grandmother's collection of music, and you happen to find one of these, I'll leave my business card on the back. You can mail it to me immediately. But But I wanted to tell you how you could tell if you had a gold mine, because there's one distinctive thing about this first imprint that identifies it, which is that there's a typo. Anybody see it? It's pretty small. So it's right there. The Star-Spangled Banner, a periodic song. Right, so the T is missing from patriotic. So if you happen to have a periodic song in your piano bench at home, I would definitely put it in acid-free paper and donate it to the University of Michigan. But you have a very valuable piece of sheet music. So this gives us a little bit of sense of the history of the song and where it comes from. What I want to talk about now is this other theme that we're working with today about the way in which we can look at the history of the United States through the lens, or through the ears, if you will, of the Star-Spangled Banner. So we know that it tells us about this particular moment, right? The Battle of Baltimore in September 13 and 14, 1814. And that we, in a sense, when we sing this song, we're looking through Francis Scott Key's eyes. We're sharing his anxiety, is the flag going to be there? We're sharing his relief that the flag is still there. We're sharing his thankfulness in the heaven-rescued land, right? And that our, that God, in Francis Scott Key, who was a very religious man, considered a career in the ministry, but it didn't pay well enough to support all the kids he had. So he ended up staying in law. But he really felt that God had changed his mind, you know, that at the burning of Baltimore, or of Washington, D.C., he was on one side, and he came over to the other side when he got to Baltimore. So for him, this was a very profound moment that he captures in the Star-Spangled Banner. But if we look at the various ways in which this music is sung, the musical style of it, the tempo of it, the ways in which the arrangements have changed, the ways in which the musical styles have changed, the ways in which the texts, I talk about all these other lyrics that are sung to the Star-Spangled Banner, if we look at those different texts, we actually see the whole story of America in through this same melody. So I want to actually go back first, before Francis Scott Key writes the Star-Spangled Banner, and talk a little bit about how this melody gets associated with American identity in the first place. Because what Key is doing is actually picking up on a popular wave of treating this particular melody as an American melody, even before he writes the words we now know as our national anthem. So the very first parody text that I found, the new lyric written to this melody, is by one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, Francis Hopkinson, from 1790. And it's really more in this kind of sort of Greek battle drinking song kind of vein. It's more of a humorous song than a political song, and actually was not even published in his day. It was just a manuscript and was found long after his death. Where it really starts to enter American public discourse is in a series of songs responding to the French Revolution. So there was Charles Edmond Genet, who was the French ambassador to the United States, who sort of came over. France, of course, with Lafayette, has supported the American Revolution, and when the French Revolution was going on, they sort of expected Americans to sign up, right, to join a battalion that would go over to France and fight in the Revolution. Genet comes over, starts raising an army. He's having considerable success. Washington is like, nope. We're going to stay neutral. Right? We had this kind of Switzerland approach at that time, in part because England was a big trading partner economically with the United States, and France was often at war with England, and so we were trying to sort of play nice with both sides. That, of course, didn't go over very well with some of the French. And there was this battle between sort of pro-French songs and pro-English songs that were all being sung to the tune that we now know as the Star-Spangled Banner. Many of them mocking Ambassador Genet, many of them celebrating the glory of the French Revolution. There were songs celebrating George Washington's birthday sung to the tune we now know as the Star-Spangled Banner. Probably the earliest and most popular song was a song called Adams and Liberty, which was supporting President John Adams. It's often called the first presidential campaign song, but in fact it's not. It was written after Adams was elected. But it really is dealing with the whole controversy over the quasi-war with France and the Alien and Sedition Act and the suspension of habeas corpus and all these other problems that really were going on during his administration. And this song is basically supporting Adams. And there were songs celebrating the 4th of July. The 4th of July is one of our earliest holidays. It's first celebrated in 1777. And very frequently, the tunes sung to celebrate the 4th of July were using the same melody we know as the Star-Spangled Banner. There are also a series of patriotic songs, including this one here, which is, you can see Poets Corner. It's taken from one of those newspapers I mentioned before. This one is a newspaper from Washington, D.C., and it says, prepared for and sung by a gentleman of Georgetown. Do you know any gentlemen from Georgetown? It's Mr. Key himself. At an entertainment given in honor of Captain Stephen Decatur, Jr., and Charles Stewart, who were heroes from the Tripolitan War, sort of the first naval heroes in American history. And it's the tune, it starts, oh, warm be the welcome to gladden his ear, and loud be the joy that his perils are ended. Oh, when the warrior returns from the battle afar to the home and a country he nobly defended, oh, warm be the welcome to gladden his ear, and loud be the joy that his perils are ended. I think I'm too high here, but I'll... for me, but in the full tide of song, let his fame roll along to the feast flowing board, let us gratefully throng, where mixed with the olive, the laurel shall wave and form a bright wreath for the brow of the brave. And so this is a tune written by Francis Scott Key to celebrate American military heroes at a dinner party in Washington, D.C., where he's basically trying to impress the other leaders and society of Washington, D.C. He's a young lawyer, just come to town at this point, and it's sung to the tune of Anacreon. So when he's 9 years later on that boat in the Chesapeake Bay looking for a melody for his song to celebrate the heroes of American military, he turns to something he knows well and he's used before. Full tide of song, let his fame roll along to the feast-flowing board, let us gratefully throng. Triple rhyme. Lines 5 and 6, right? So he knows the form, he knows the Anacreontic original, he knows how to be a sophisticated poet and lyricist writing an Anacreontic parody. He's got 8 lines, 9 rhymes. And you can see here that these last 2 lines are in italics. Everything else is in Roman type. Why are the last 2 lines in italics? They're repeated, right? So the form is that's the repeat. So the audience, the people at the party celebrating Decatur and Stewart are meant and know that they're supposed to join in for those last 2 lines. So did someone else put music to Francis Scott Key's poem? I think not, right? He wrote a song. This is one of my, I think, the most powerful parodies that I've found, and it happens to be in this very library, which is sort of a fun bit of research that brought me back here. This is from an abolitionist newspaper published in Ann Arbor, Michigan in 1844, called The Signal of Liberty. And we have the complete run here in the Ann Arbor District Library. It's written by a minister named E.A. Attlee from Battle Creek, Michigan. And it says, for the Signal of Liberty, a new version of the national song, The Star-Spangled Banner by E.A. Attlee. Oh, say do ye hear at the dawn's early light. So we're already parodying Key's lyric. We've mentioned that the melody is not Anacreon anymore. The melody is the Star-Spangled Banner. The shrieks of those bondsmen whose blood is now streaming from the merciless lash, while our banner in sight with its stars mocking freedom is fitfully gleaming. Do you see the backs bare? Do you mark every score of the whip of the driver trace channels of gore? Oh, say, doth our Star-Spangled Banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave? So there's a whole series of these abolitionist texts that are written to the tune of the Star-Spangled Banner that use that last phrase about the land of the free and the home of the brave, ironically or in a questioning way, to say, how can we be a land that cherishes freedom if there's so many people here who aren't free? Right. So, the key phrase is, who do we define as people? Right. Who do we define as citizens? We didn't, of course, define women as citizens, and at least in the right to vote at this time either. But really one of the most powerful texts, I think, ever written to that melody. And it's building upon the growing popularity of Key's song as a symbol of the nation. Actually quoting the lyrics of Key's anthem, not quite anthem, but what's already become a very important national patriotic song, to sort of offer commentary on the lyrics to shape not just a symbol of us, but to really ask a question about, well, what should this country be? How should we live up to these ideals that are celebrated in the song? And so that's, I think, really what's fascinating to me about all of these different lyrics that are sung to the melody, is that it's part of this conversation, this national discussion about what America really should be. Like, how do we live up to our ideals? What are our ideals? What does it mean to be American? And poetry in song is something that has to be enacted, right? It doesn't live if it's just on the page, right? You have to sing it. You have to bring it to life. You have to sort of commit yourself to it. So that when you're at Michigan Stadium this fall and you're all excited, so I hope you'll commit yourself to singing the song, but it does take a kind of participation to really make a song, an anthem, come to life. And so it was, you know, using it in this way that sort of builds that citizenship, I think, through song. This is a recital we did a year ago, on July 3rd, actually, right before July 4th, with the baritone Thomas Hampson.
Shall we ne'er hail the day when as freemen shall stand the million shall groan under matchless oppression, shall liberty shout in our heaven-rescued land, ne'er be shared by the slave in our blood-guilty nation. Oh, let us be just, ere in God we dare trust, else the day will o'ertake us when perish we must. And our star-spangled banner at half-mast shall wave o'er the deathbed of freedom and the home of us.
So that brings us to the U.S. Civil War. And this, in many ways, the Civil War is fought just as passionately in culture as it is on the battlefield. I mean, there are these horrific battles, Cold Harbor, Gettysburg. It remains the deadliest war in American history. But there's a lot of time between the battles. And what's happening between the battles is a kind of ideological warfare that's really played out in songs. And there are an enormous number of songs, thousands of songs, that are written during the Civil War. Frederick Rood in Chicago is cranking out things like the battle cry, the battle hymn of the Republic, right? Battle Cry of Freedom. There's all of these different songs that are really as much a part of the war as are the bullets and the guns. And, you know, it's that passion, that commitment, that willingness to fight in these incredibly deadly battles that were just as, you know, that were essential to making the battles happen for each side. And so each side really puts out a lot of music. Because of the industrial power of the North, we are also not only able to make more guns, we're able to make more songs. We're able to print more songs. So there are more Northern songs than Southern songs. Interestingly, the warfare between North and South plays out in their treatment of the national anthem, which, of course, isn't quite the national anthem yet, but a treatment of the Star-Spangled Banner as well. It starts out, really, with both sides claiming the national anthem as their own, right? So the Confederacy sees that the symbols of the country, the flag, the crest, the Hail Columbia, the Star-Spangled Banner, they're the sort of true symbols of America, and each side consider themselves the true Americans. Each saw the other side as betraying some fundamental truth of the country, and therefore we needed to maintain it. So both the North and the South claim the Star-Spangled Banner at first. So this is a quote from a newspaper in New Orleans. "Hold to our Hail Columbia and our Star-Spangled Banner. In peace, they serve to remind us of the importance of preparing for war, and they alone aroused the thirst in our children's breasts for knowledge of the noble deeds of our forefathers. In war, they will carry us irresistibly all over obstacles. They have done it ever and will do it if we are but true to them." And then maybe the same guy, writing in another New Orleans newspaper, writes a couple months later, "These tunes and anthems of right belong to the South. We should cherish and perpetuate them instead of throwing them back into the possession of those who have causelessly and wantonly become our enemies. Instead of abandoning Let us claim them as our own legitimate property. They are a proud portion of our birthright. Right? So he's ultimately not successful. The fact that the other side is carrying around the Star-Spangled Banner flag and his side is not really ends up undercutting the Star-Spangled Banner as a symbol of the Confederacy. They actually turn to things like the Marseillaise, which was sort of the model of great national anthems at the time and was a sort of a tune that was sung by rebels in resistance to injustice anywhere. So the South for a while picks up the Marseillaise and they come up with their own set of songs like the Bonnie Blue Flag and eventually Dixie, which ironically is a song written in the North. But nevertheless, what they start doing then is writing these parody lyrics, these alternate lyrics to mock the Star-Spangled Banner and to criticize the North. So this is one of the fun ones. And we can see again that he's the author of this one who is parodying Francis Scott Key's text. "Oh, say, can't you see by the dawn's early light what you yesterday held to be vaunting and dreaming? The Northern men routed, Abe Lincoln in flight, and the Palmetto flag or the Capitol streaming. The pumpkins for fair, the foul-fetid air gave proof through the night that the Yankees were there. Now the flag of secession in triumph doth wave, or the land of the freed and the home of the brave." Right. So this is, there are four verses here with the flag of secession. I think I might have a little bit of this on recording. Maybe? I bet it didn't. There it is.
See by the dawn's early light what you yesterday held to be vaunting and dreaming. The Northern men routed Abe Lincoln in flight, and the Palmetto flag o'er the Capitol streaming. The pumpkins for fair, the foul-feeted air
So a year later, they're singing a new popular song called Farewell to the Star-Spangled Banner, which is written by Mrs. Frances Hundley, who was the wife of a plantation owner in just outside of Richmond.
Farewell forever, the Star-Spangled Banner, no longer shall wave o'er the land of the free, but will unfurl to the broad breeze of heaven 13 bright stars around the palmetto tree.
Oops. In the North, one of our sort of national poets who inherits the mantle of Francis Scott Key is Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who often created verse for important national events. And so for July 4th in 1861, he actually writes an additional fifth verse to the Star-Spangled Banner, which criticizes the traitors who have left the nation, and actually is one of the first texts that sort of calls for the freeing of the slaves that I know of that's sung to the tune of the Star-Spangled Banner. So one of the things I like about this is that Holmes actually changes the last verse or last phrase and says, "And the Star-Spangled Banner in triumph shall wave while the land of the free is the home of the brave," sort of in equating the freeing of the slaves about creating a more legitimate freedom for this land with the triumph of the nation. So when the Civil War comes to a conclusion, not everybody is all that happy about it. There's a new conclusion to the Star-Spangled Banner, another fifth verse written by one of the Confederate lyricists, says, "Accursed be the name that have covered with shame that flag, once the emblem of glory and fame. For the Star-Spangled Banner no longer doth wave are the land of the free and the home of the brave. So this sense of betrayal as the Confederacy really starts to crumble and march through Georgia and is happening with General Grant. 4 years later, we have the National Peace Jubilee in Boston, and there's yet another new lyric trying to heal the nation using, again, the Star-Spangled Banner and the additional fifth verse. War's clamors now o'er, with her mantle hath peace, again in its folds the nation enshrouded. Let no fratricide hand uplifted e'er be, the glory to dim which now is unclouded. Not as North or as South in the future will stand, but as brothers united throughout our loved land. And the Star-Spangled Banner forever shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. So not everybody believed it, but there was an attempt to use the Star-Spangled Banner as a kind of healing ritual. And what I see in accounts of patriotic ceremonies in the South sort of following the Civil War is that Dixie and the Star-Spangled Banner are always paired in the South as a way both to sort of honor the Confederate soldiers who are still alive, of course, at that point, and then, but also to assert the primacy of the sort of national sonic identity. Some other interesting bits of sort of social history that become visible in these various texts of the Star-Spangled Banner is issues of assimilation and immigration. So if you remember, maybe in 2006, there was a version of the Star-Spangled Banner that was released using a Spanish text, and it was sort of inserted into the political debate about immigration and the building of the fence alongside Mexico. This was during the George Bush Jr. administration. But actually it used a text from 1919. So the translation they used of the Star-Spangled Banner was actually a text that had been published in the United States and was a semi-official translation of the national anthem into Spanish from just right after the Civil War, or not Civil War, World War I. The very first translation I've located is a German translation that actually is connected with the founding of a German colony or a German city in Texas in 1850. And then it gets used as a recruiting tool by Union troops. A publisher in New York puts it out as a way to bring sort of the descendants of former Hessian troops from the Revolutionary War into the Union side. So there's a German translation used by the government for recruiting purposes in 1862. There's a Latin version from 1918, a French version from 1918, which is actually sort of calling upon the United States to enter the war and support the Allied powers. There's that Spanish version, as I mentioned, from 1919. There are Hebrew and Yiddish versions from the 1930s, which I think are bringing awareness and you know, to the Jewish community as tensions in Germany and the atrocities there start to build. There are versions in Native American languages. Today there are translations in Asian languages, in Russian, sort of pretty much in any language you can possibly imagine, American Samoan. So this notion of the banner as a way to sort of welcome people to the country, to sort of expand the definition of citizenship, is actually sort of built into the history of the song. Even though today, if you were to be on the presidential campaign trail and to sing it in a different language, you'd probably undergo a considerable amount of criticism, right? Because it's supposed to be in English. I mean, that's part of the pressure that was put on Bush. And Bush, of course, used Spanish versions of the Star-Spangled Banner when he was campaigning for governor of Texas, right? Which has great numbers of Spanish-speaking people in San Antonio and other places. So another, I think, version which I use for my students all the time has to do with Jimi Hendrix and the Star-Spangled Banner and his performance at Woodstock, which is just was pointed out to me right before. We'll be celebrating its anniversary tomorrow because it was August 18th, 1969. He was supposed to go on August 17th in the evening, Sunday night, but the concert was so far behind schedule that he actually went out on Monday morning. And the legend is told that as the sun was rising, Jimi Hendrix plays the Star-Spangled Banner. He's actually playing at about 10 o'clock in the morning, but it makes a much better story with the rising. But Hendrix was really the featured artist at the Woodstock Art Fair. That's why he was closing the festival. And this is his performance. Thank you. Probably one of the more infamous versions of the Star Spangled Banner. And so the question has to do with, well, what does this mean? And what does it mean is something we can answer when we start looking actually the history of Jimi Hendrix's engagement with the song, which is actually a two-year-long odyssey. It starts around the time of August, actually a year before Woodstock, and goes to over a year after Woodstock, just up until Hendrix's death. And a lot of varied interpretation of what this means. Some people are very celebratory of this particular version. Other people find it to be meaningless. As the cheapest kind of sensationalism, as Pete Johnson from the LA Times wrote. So my own interpretation of this is that it's actually a pretty balanced rendition. Certainly if we compare it to Hendrix's other performances, he plays all of the notes in tune and in rhythm, and the sort of psychedelic departures are illustrations of the text. So if we get to looking, if you sing the text or say the text to yourself along with Hendrix's guitar playing, he's actually singing the song with his guitar. So when he gets to words like Perilous Fight, Ramparts, Rockets Red Glare, or Bombs Bursting in Air, this is where the sort of psychedelic departures are happening. So they're happening as illustrations of rockets and bombs, both in reference to the Vietnam War and in reference to sort of racial tension and rioting in the wake of Martin Luther King's death and other incidents in the United States. Part of what you have to remember is that Hendrix himself was a member of the 101st Airborne, was a veteran himself and had friends and sort of neighbors from his time growing up in Seattle who were in Vietnam at the time. So the 101st Airborne, of course, was legendary from D-Day in World War II, but also was deployed entirely in Vietnam at this time. The other thing you have to remember is that this is August of 1969, which is long after the Tet Offensive, and sort of American public opinion and much of the controversy of the Vietnam War predates this by 4 or 5 years in certain cases. So, for instance, Muhammad Ali, who's another outspoken critic of the war, I mean, his sort of refusal to go into the army, I think, is from 1964. So Hendrix, in some ways, is rather late to the protest, even though the sort of protest angle of this song is celebrated as a very symbolic of the 1960s. It's actually really more of a capstone to tension over Vietnam than it is a generative aspect of that. But there's certainly connections. So this is the illustration of Rocket's Red Glare. So where it comes in, and of course the social context of both Martin Luther King and of Vietnam. But if Hendrix had been wanting to dismember or destroy the anthem, which is something he's often criticized for, he wouldn't have played it as musically in such a sound way as he ends up doing, at least in my opinion. And if you compare it to other performances that Hendrix has made over the anthem, and there's some 40 that are recorded on audience tapes and actually were commercially released, this one actually stands out for its respect for the song, in my opinion. And part of that has to do, I want to think, with Hendrix's own feelings about Woodstock as an event. So he saw the sort of peace, love, and happiness and the ability of the youth of America to be able to gather together in a productive way as being really an optimistic sign for the country, sort of the political future of the country. So for him, I think the performing the Star Spangled Banner, which was not part of the planned set list for that morning, but was part of his encore for that evening, which is why it wasn't happening when Dawn was happening, was really part of it. A couple weeks after Woodstock, he appears on the Dick Cavett Show, which was the late night talk show of the era, like the Tonight Show. And he's really talking about sort of the political power of music and the way he sees music as a place where citizenship is practiced. And that's really my conclusion for this talk, is that this is a copy of my own U.S. passport. And if you open the inside cover, you see that famous picture by Percy Moran, right, from 1912, showing the Star-Spangled Banner at dawn's early light, the beginning of the text, in Francis Scott Key's own handwriting. So it's something that's very intimately attached to American identity, our sense of who we are as a people, the who we are as citizens. And then this ability to perform the song, as I argued a little bit before, is because it's an act, it's not something you can do passively. It's something you have to actually sing. It's something we sing as a community at events from military funerals to sporting events. It's a practice of citizenship. And so I think the stylistic variation, the variation in text, the variation in sort of musical, I would say accent, if you will, are all different views on what it means to be American. So this particular song is a place where we're still negotiating today, sort of who has the right to sing the song and what it means in different contexts. And I think the fact that we sing this song so often is, for me, is a very optimistic take on what it means to be American, and it sort of responds in the same way that Francis Scott Key did in Baltimore Harbor 200 years ago, where he saw a sort of important moment of American history and then put his personal spin on it by creating a lyric that reflected his feelings to that particular moment.